Within the deepest recesses of the darkest corners, in the dingiest of libraries, on refectory tables, within dens of debauchery, places of erudition, libraries, bookstores, bedrooms, living rooms, motel rooms, majestic halls illuminated by dim light bulbs, these 21 lip blockers did read again. Five nominees, 21 lip blockers, the Lit Blog Co-op.
Five
nominees and a blackjack to peruse their innards. Ladies and gentlemen, readers of all deviant persuasions, including vanilla, please join us as we momentarily preempt Mr. Segundo the next round of the LBC Podcast.
Hello, other webland. Welcome to week number two of the Lit Blog Co-op Podcast. My name is Edward Champion. I'm producer of the Pat Segundo Show. Again, Mr. Segundo declines to actually become involved with this particular segment of our podcasts, but that's okay. We'll let him go ahead and get blotto. This week, we have a fantastic little novel by Jeffrey Ford called The Girl in the Glass. It's set in the Great Depression. It's a mystery, which is interesting because Mr. Ford generally specializes in speculative fiction. Not so with this particular novel. In fact, there are characters here who are girls who are not in the glass, which suggests a possible sort of alternative title, The Girl in the Glass and The Girl Who Is Not in the Glass. But, of course, that might be a little, you know, too long. It might get your tongue tied. So we'll go ahead and settle for The Girl in the Glass. I think that's, you know, succinct. It's to the point. It gets the message across. Anyway, we had the pleasure of chatting not only with Mr. Ford, but Gwenda Bond of the Lit Blog, Shaken Not Stirred, who nominated this particular title. And we will go ahead and talk with Gwenda right now. I am here with Gwenda Bond, Shaken Not Stirred. She nominated the book Jeffrey Ford's The Girl in the Glass. Gwenda, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm doing well. Are you doing well?
Yes,
okay.
Still is.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Why did this book strike you as a LBC nominee?
Well, I think that Jeff Ford is a writer that I've loved for a really long time, and I feel like his work doesn't always find the audience that it deserves because he is a very adventurous writer, and he writes in a lot of different kinds of genres, and so, you know, he's had several novels. The first ones were published as fantasy, and then after that he wrote a novel, The Portrait of Mrs. Charbouk, which was published as literary fiction, and now The Girl in the Glass comes out by a brand new mystery imprint. So I think that readers probably either don't know who Jeff Ford is or think he's either one of those three kinds of writers and don't have any idea that he's sort of all kinds of writers.
I believe he remarked on his live journal that apparently some reviewer noted that this guy, Jeff Ford, came out of nowhere. And then and he responded, hey, what the hell? I've been writing for 10 years.
Or I'm surprised he didn't respond. I came out of New Jersey.
Yeah, that's true, too. Well, why do you think that someone like Jeff Ford kind of gets a bad rap or is, you know, permitted to essentially remain invisible to certain sort of literary people?
Well, I think that, for one thing, he tends to work with kind of elements in his material. I'll take Girl in the Glass as an example because that's the book that we're talking about. I mean, this book has the spiritualist movement. It has con men. It has Murder, Most Foul. It has Coney Island circus freaks. It has, you know, strange butterflies, and is set in 1932. And I think that some readers are kind of put off by what they think are these sort of outrageous kind of tropes. And then you read the novel, and he brings it completely to life, and is also dealing with all these complex issues that are economic and racial and social from that time period. And it just, I mean, you know, Jeff's work always blows me away that he's able to make it such an effortless read, and yet there's all this complexity under the surface. And I think a lot of readers probably miss the complexity under the surface when they're sort of giving a cursory glance to what this novel is.
Okay, one last question before we vamoose here, but what do you think we can do to get science fiction or speculative fiction or even writers like Ford more legitimacy, more credence?
Well, I think hope that it's happening because the literary world is sort of is turning away from that definition that seemed to have kind of dominated for the last few decades of realist fiction is serious literary fiction. And now we're returning to kind of a more inclusive definition of what literary fiction can be, and writers aren't being forced to give up their childhood kind of pleasures. You know, we have writers like Jonathan Liesel and Michael Chabon making it completely respectable to write about things that, you know, maybe 2 decades ago it would only have been acceptable to write about if you were a writer being translated who happened to live in Latin America. So.
Sure, sure. Well, Gwenda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm here with Jeffrey Ford, author of the LDC nominee, The Girl in the Glass. Jeff, how are you doing today?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well myself, hyped up on coffee here. So, warning you in advance. I wanted to first of all say, you've thrown in almost everything but the kitchen sink into this plot. You've got con men, Mexican immigrants, a eugenics records office, a strong man, mysticism, ghosts, a cast of thousands. What steps did you take to whittle this all down into a clean narrative? Were there any other narrative elements that didn't make it into this book? Or?
No, I tell you, it was pretty amazing how the book came about, because when I started to think about it, I wanted to do something about spiritualists in the 1930s. And I wanted to write another book in the New York area based on Long Island, like my previous novel, Mr. Sharpook, was based in New York and partially on Long Island. But when I started to investigate this stuff, in addition to the spiritualist things that came up, I found these two items of historical interest. One was the Mexican repatriation, and one was the eugenics record office. And once I found those two things, I knew I had to get them into the book, because those two things would tie together today's world and the world of the 1930s for me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I was tossing stuff out, but when I had those two ideas, I had to get them in, just because I thought it would make the story much more pertinent to today's readers, you know? I don't know if that really answers your question. I didn't throw a lot out. I did a lot of editing, though.
Oh, gotcha. Well, we'll talk about that in just a bit. But I wanted to point out that for this book, and also The Portrait of Mrs. Sharbuk, you actually adopted less fantastical elements than your previous works, and actually more mystery elements. I was wondering, also the language is also less Baroque here. It's more sort of direct. I was wondering why this sudden shift in your work?
Well, you know, I had done quite a number of books that had kind of a 19th century feel in the writing to them, and I wanted to try something different. I mean, if you don't try new things as a writer, you're just going to be writing the same book again and again, you know what I mean? That's a drag for everybody, the reader as well as the writer. This time I had been influenced by Dashiell Hammett and a lot of the mystery writers, and some of the contemporary ones too, like I think the guy's name is Crumley, the guy that wrote The Last Good Kiss. And, you know, and these guys, the writing is very pared down, James M. Cain, and very pared down, and it moves quickly, you know, and a lot of dialogue, especially Hammett. Use a lot of this sharp dialogue, you know? And I wanted to emulate that. In writing it, though, I didn't want to write a hard-boiled novel. I'm not really a big hard-ass, you know what I mean? So I really couldn't pull that off. But in Hammett's book, The Thin Man is kind of a noir comedy in a way. And that's what I wanted to try and emulate, was that idea of that being humor as well as a lot of the noir elements of mystery in it, you know? And also to try to get that style, that short, snappy style, and see if I could work that in the book and, you know, see how it would come out. Now, I don't use a lot of, like, there are more fantastic elements in this particular book, if you're really looking, than there are in Mrs. Sharbuk, although that's not the way it was perceived by readers. But, you know, a lot of times you can get a nice tension if there's the possibility exists of some kind of supernatural element, and you play right along the edge of it, you know what I mean? Skate right along the edge, you get a nice tension from that. I go back and I write things that are more fantastical, and I'll probably do things that are much less fantastical than even these books in the future. I don't really like to get pinned down as far as, like, well, you're a fantasy writer, you're a mystery writer. It's just the things I decide to, you know, utilize at that particular moment, or the things that move me to, you know, to write at that moment.
Well, to talk also about mystery influences, the relationship between Thomas Schell and Diego reminded me very much of Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin. It's also the cultivated detective and his sarcastic assistant. I was wondering if Rex Stout was also an influence.
No, you see, now those guys, I haven't really read that deeply in mystery. I mean, with the exception of the guys that I mentioned, Rex Stout I have no idea about, and I know the guys you're talking about, Archie Goodwin, but I really haven't read any of that stuff. My mom was a big mystery reader, and if I know anything about those guys, it's, you know, from listening to her talk about them. But other than that, I'm really at a loss. I don't really have that, you know, that thing. I was thinking more with that kind of a relationship. I was thinking more along the lines of, there was a book I read when I was a kid, like a kid's book, called The Magic Lantern Show, and I can't remember who it was by, but there was a magician, and he adopts this kid in it. And it's a very old book. I read it, when, you know, going back to the 50s when I read it in the school library. But it really touched me, that book. I never forgot about it. And I think that kind of influenced this relationship in this book to some extent, you know?
Yep. Well, I think it's interesting because with Rex Stout, Nero Wolfe sort of has this, he's this cultivated man. He very much enjoys orchids. And you have with Thomas Schell, he has this butterfly interest. It's I swear to God, man. It was like I was thinking.
You think I was really ripping.
Yeah, no, I mean not entirely, but it was I actually thought that it was a dead influence on this book.
You know, the thing is, that's the trouble when you're writing fiction. It never fails. Either something that you've done that you're not aware of is out there already, or when you're waiting for your book to come out, another book comes out with the exact same damn theme. You know what I mean? That never fails, I'm telling you.
Well, even down to the humor of Rex Stout, it was very similar. I was like thinking, man, you know, there's a lot of, a bit of, it's funny how this happens.
I have to read that now.
Yeah, they're really fun little books. I've actually managed to get a whole bunch of them at an estate sale years ago, and I had heard the name, and I was like, really enjoyed them. I do recommend them. They're fun little books, you know.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, what about this kind of book also reminded me of Glenn David Gould's Carter Beats the Devil. Was this an inspiration for you, or in terms of down to the research that Gould did?
I had a lot of my friends suggested that book to me, but I never got around to reading it. I'll tell you why, because I thought that book was going to be a lot like Mrs. Jabouk when I was writing it, and I didn't really want it to influence me then. So I passed that one by. I heard really good things about it. I never got a chance to check it out, though, you know? And then this one, when I started this one, I was too busy with it to go back and read that. But I had heard, I'm ignorant of that story, but I heard great things about that book.
Yeah. Well, it's also similar kind of quirky characters and the like. But, I mean, okay, well, this is a classic sort of case that I think every author faces. Anyway, but going down to one more influence I kind of sort of caught, the explanation of the con techniques reminded me very much of the David Mamet film House of Games. I was wondering if this might have been an influence, or how many of these cons did you actually invent as an author?
Well, you know, what I was amazed about. Now, I know that movie, mm-hmm. House of Games. I think that's a movie with Joe Mantegna.
Yes.
Right? That what goes back a ways. And I'd seen the movie. I really didn't even think about that when I was doing the book, because I'd seen it a long time ago. But that's a cool movie, actually. I know the one you're talking about. As far as the stuff goes in here, I was amazed when I did the research what these spiritualist guys got away with. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had fishing rods with tambourines on the end of them, dangling over people. And one of the things that most amazed me is the fact that at how much people wanted to believe and how gullible it made them. I mean, it's just incredible, the stuff they got away with. That was just outlandish. I mean, you know, some of the stuff that they do in the book, I was afraid that people would think that, this could never happen. People would never go for this, you know. When in reality, I played it kind of safe because I was afraid people would say, oh, well, that's too outlandish. But the stuff that these guys actually got away with was completely outlandish, that people believed were actually ghosts and so forth, you know. And it's a time period, too, at that time, you know. Science was making great strides and so forth, and, you know, there was a lot of that going on, but there was a lot of ignorance in the world as far as, like, not as many people educated and so forth, you know,
mm-hmm.
and religion still played a big part, and there was a lot of mysticism and spiritualism still around, so I think that's how they got away with it, you know what I mean? I can't think of it, as far as the cons went, I made up all of them, you know, all the ones in there, but I had read books by, like, Houdini And there were some facsimile editions of his books in print. I think Dover puts them out. And some of the other places I've read, and James Randi, I think that's his name. He has a really good book on Flim Flam. But I just got kind of this by the flavor of it, and then I just made this stuff up.
Huh. Well, it's interesting what you mentioned about gullibility, because I was reading this and I was saying, you know, there are a lot of money men here in the Great Depression who are so easily willing to impart with their cash.
I guess that's right.
And I was sort of thinking to myself, this couldn't be right. But then at the same time, I was also thinking, well, maybe people were more susceptible, as you point out. It's interesting that you played it safe. Are there any other aspects of this that you felt, you know, may not have been credible to the reader that you kind of played it safe with? Or?
Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing that I was worried. Let me just go back to one thing you said, and then I'll answer
sure.
that. But, you know, the Depression really grinding poverty in a lot of cases, and these spiritualists really thrived during this time. And for them to do that, it couldn't have been on these poor people. It had to be on the rich, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there was, this gullibility was pretty amazing. I mean, you know, you got a guy like Conan Doyle who was a complete supporter of it, and he was a well-off guy, and he was an educated guy, and a writer, and a guy who he probably should have known better, you know? But he was a huge supporter of it, and he wasn't the only one. He had a lot of friends in, like, upper-class places that dug the spiritualist stuff. As far as being worried about, I don't know if I played it safe, but I was very worried about presenting a Mexican character.
Mm.
You know what I mean? A Hispanic character, which is, especially from this time period of the Depression, of immigrant at this time, you know, I was kind of worried about that because I didn't really have much, you know, I didn't have any personal experience with it. But what I did was I did a lot of reading. I talked to people. Talked to Mexican people who had come to the country, you know, not that far back, but more recently. And then I just, like, had to get into the head and try to go with it. And one of the ways I made it easier on myself was he was raised and kind of Americanized by this guy, you know what I mean? So that was something that always troubled me about the book, and I'm always wondering to this day if a Mexican reader were to pick it up, or somebody with, you know, Mexican background were to pick it up, would it read for them legitimately or not, you know what I mean?
Gotcha. Well, I also wanted to point out that I found a message that you posted in the Nightshade Books discussion forum that HarperCollins initially was going to release this book as a hardcover, but then they claimed that this was maybe a little too different from your other books, and then they released it as a paperback original. You sort of hypothesized that it was because this book was perhaps too political, but while there are certainly undercurrents in this book that are political, I don't know if this was really sort of, like, overburdening the plot. I didn't really get the sense this was any more political than, say, like, Terry Pratchett's Thud or anything. What are your feelings on this?
No, I agree with you. I think it was just me, like, you know, spinning. My wheels were spinning, you know? You get involved, and you get deeply involved in the book. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that I think could be very political. But the people didn't notice it. I don't think the publisher really realized it either, to tell you the truth at this point, you know, in hindsight. The fact that, you know, the fact that Bush's grandfather was involved in this eugenics and his family was involved in it early on, I thought might be something that would be political. The whole idea of this eugenics thing in today's world, I think it's playing itself out again in a lot of different ways. I think with the attitudes of evangelical Christians toward other people in the country and other types of people in the country, this is playing itself out. I think the Mexican repatriation thing is playing itself out in what's going on the borders, on both sides of the border now, you know what I mean? So I think it's really charged politically if you choose to think of it that way. There's one of the things I think maybe why people don't is because the story is pretty engaging and it moves quickly, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I'm not sure if you looked at the, in today's New York Times Magazine, there was this interesting article that was by Jennifer Egan about sperm donors. And there was this really astonishing quote from this German woman who's trying to sort of find the right sperm, and she says, oh, I must have a sort of multicultural thing, but there's no justification for it. It's just the theory that, like, this is what everything is meant to be, and it's really just astonished me to see that such a sort of eugenics-based kind of thing in this sort of relatively benign article, interesting topic, you know, it just goes to show you again that, you know, it's still very much in our public consciousness.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it absolutely is. And it's, I mean, you know, it's, you know, if you see, well, this is an example of, like, you know, gay marriage was such a big issue during the last election, you know what I mean? That's the issue that decided that the last presidential election had nothing to do with the war in Iraq, although it should have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That issue, which was really, to me, a non-issue, I mean, you know, as far as, like, people who love each other getting married, that was a huge issue. And that's the kind of stuff that these people in the eugenics movement early on thought that you could rid the country of by purifying the bloodline. And that's the kind of place where this gets, you know, the creepiness of it back then is the creepiness of it now to me. Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Yeah. We're doing just fine. Well, the character names, you have Anthony Cleopatra, you have Morgan, Merlin. And I was also thinking that Charlotte Barnes might have been sort of, you know, a sly reference to Charlotte Bronte, perhaps. The names in this book had me wondering if you were sort of writing chapters while you were prepping to teach a class or something. And I should also note that the book's chapters are sort of brisk. I was wondering if you could maybe respond to these two points. When do you write, and were the names sort of culled from your Norton anthologies, or?
No. The names were, well, I'd always had it in my mind to have a strong man in a story called Anthony Cleopatra. This goes back to the time when I was a kid, when I'd write stories. Now, I just thought that was the funniest thing. It may not be that humorous, but I enjoyed it, you know? As far as the other names, I picked those two names because Morgan and Merlin, because they were the spiritual hope of, like, that whole Aryan, you know, wasp, thing, that whole, you know, going back to the beginnings of, like, you know, King Arthur and so forth. And I could see this guy using those names as symbolic of what they were looking for, you know, this kind of whiteness and so forth. That's why I used those names, because it was like some kind of bad symbolism that this guy would dream up, you know. The other stuff, I don't know, the other names don't strike me as that. Although Shell is kind of a symbolic name, I guess. Not that I thought of it when I came up with it, but later, like the Shell game, you know what I mean? Those Shell games they used to have.
Or even Maximilian Shell, I don't know.
Well, actually, you know what the thing is? The guy's name wasn't Thomas Shell in the beginning when I started writing. It was Jonathan Shell. And then I was listening to NPR, and I realized, like, there's a writer called Jonathan Shell who writes about, I think, like, the economy or something like that, you know? And I was like, oh, I can't use that now. I got to find something else. As far as how much the Norton anthology, you know, influenced me, I can't say. Who knows? It might have, though. When do I write, though? Is that what you asked me?
Yeah, I did.
When? I write at night when I get home from work, you know. And a couple of days I'm off during the week. So, you know, late at night. I've written for years late at night. It's starting to catch up with me. I'm getting older now. And, you know, but I stay up late. I only need, like, 4 hours of sleep a night. I mean, I've done that. I really conditioned myself to be like that so I could write, you know?
Yeah, I know the feeling. I'm a similarly light sleeper like that myself, or short sleeper.
Well, it feels like you could take, like, that power nap for 10 minutes and stay up for another 3 hours, you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Insane, this whole thing. Well, when I talked with Rupert Thompson, It struck me as sort of a similar technique, research-wise, as what he did for his books. He basically did a hell of a lot of research, and then he spent many drafts whittling down this sort of mammoth text down to the bare essentials. And reading The Girl in the Glass, I sort of got the sense that you may have operated in a similar way. What is the research specifically that you used for the last two books?
Well, I do a lot of research. I mean, you know, and I enjoy that part, actually. When I first did this, the historic Mrs. Strabook, which was, you know, my editor said, I want you to put this story in a historical setting. Because the other ones I'd done before, the fun of it was I'd just make everything up, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, she said, I want you to try and put this in a historical setting. And at first I was like, oh, this is going to be a drag. But then when I started taking a look at what she was saying, I thought it was a good idea. I went and I did it. I really had an enjoyable time doing the research. But what I found is this. a little research goes a long way. I mean, really, the thing that's really going to convince somebody of a time and a place is not so much like, you know, having a famous personage in the story, or like pointing to a piece of architecture or a statue that would have been there at the time, or, you know, having some headline or something. Although I have used those techniques before. But the thing that's really going to nail the time and place is going to be the voice, and it's going to be the style of writing. Like when you read an Edith Wharton novel, you know it's the 19th century, but she's not pointing out any landmarks, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with a Henry James novel. I know it's the 19th century, but it's the style, and it's the voice, and it's the sensibility. And if you work on those things and get those things right, you don't need as much research as, you know, as if, you know, as much physical concrete detail as you would think you need. A little bit goes a long way. And this, I mean, I had all kinds of stuff for both of these books that I couldn't put in here because, you know, but once you do it, you have this feeling like I got to get it in there, you know, because I did it. I got to use it. But you end up throwing a lot of the stuff out at the end.
Do you face the sort of battle of kind of being a sort of literary impressionist, meaning that you're so adept, perhaps, at, like, you know, getting a particular voice, like that Edith Wharton or the Henry James, but simultaneously you also have to be true to your own voice. I was wondering if you could kind of describe if you have any kind of struggle along these lines, or what you do to sort of, I guess, find that medium between the two.
Well, I'll tell you, it's always my voice. I mean, in the long run, I mean, that's what it always comes down to, or it seems like that to me. I mean, not this voice I'm speaking to in my Long Island accent, but, you know, it's always my head in there. I think there are works that I do, too, that are very autobiographical, even though they're considered, a lot of them are considered fantasy works, short stories and, you know, a novel I'm working on now, but, you know, I switch around a lot. I'm not so much an impressionist as I am, like, I'm very eclectic. I mean, as far as, like, the styles and stuff I work in, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like my voice is in all of them. That's all I can really tell you about that.
Well, I'll present you with another sort of writing dichotomy. I understand you were a student of the late John Gardner, and he quite famously dissed Harlan Ellison as an example of really bad confrontational prose. Now, I was curious, how much of Gardner's advice do you apply to your writing today, particularly this book, or even the stories in your upcoming collection, The Empire of Ice Cream? And also, to what extent do you try to grab the reader by the lapels?
Well, you know, I don't really think about his books that much when I write. I mean, I like some of his books quite a bit, like Nicholson's Ghost, I think, is just a great novel, one of the great undiscovered novels of, 20th century literature, The King's Indian, and there's a couple of his books I really admire. I don't really go back and look at his stuff all that much. I mean, as far as a teacher went, he was a good teacher because, you know, he taught me grammar. I was a real numbnut, man. I didn't even know where to put the commas when I went, you know, when I started with him. I have a page somewhere around here that's just a page of him writing out the rules of grammar for me.
Wow.
And he showed me how to edit, you know. Those were the things I learned from him the most. As far as the ideological stuff, and you know, he taught me some stuff about the actual ideas behind writing, like this vivid and continuous dream and, you know, how ways to think about writing. As far as all that stuff in on moral fiction, I mean, you know, that to me, I've written this before in other places, that was like advertisements for myself for him, you know what I mean? It was just him trying to make himself a place in among these other guys, and, you know, a lot of what he says in there is bullshit, I would think, you know. But there is a lot there in his work, and I learned a lot from him personally. The one thing I think I got from him that I still carries over is the fact that, you know, he was interested in fantasy as literature back in the 60s and 70s. And that was the time period when a lot of people were. Like, whatever they want to call Garcia Marquez, I mean, magical realist or whatever, there was always a strain of the fantastic in mixed with realism. And the demarcation point as to where it was, or calling it one genre or the other, never really entered these guys' minds, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They wrote what they wanted to write or what they had to write, and they didn't really think about what genre it had to be placed in. So I think that time period, and Cuba Weber was another guy that was doing this at the time. Pynchon was doing this. And so learning in that time period and learning from Gardner, who did a lot of that stuff with, like, Grendel and, the King's Indian, those kind of books. Learning at that time and from him, I think I took a lot of that away with me and it, in some way, directed the kind of fiction that I write, you know?
But even today, like, for example, these great postmodernists of the 1970s are, like, now considered either, you know, spent or it's like, now there's this terrible sort of, I mean, not terrible, but the emphasis towards realistic fiction, where there's this really sort of reactionary B.R. Myers kind of climate in the air. What are your thoughts on this? Does this kind of present obstacles for you as a writer or your reception as a writer?
I got to tell you, to God's honest truth, I don't even think about it. I'm just trying to write a book.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, Coover is an awesome writer to me. I know a lot of people don't like his work, but not only is he, does incredible things with language, but, I mean, he's funny as hell, too. I mean, did you read that Ghost Town book?
I haven't yet.
What?
I haven't.
No, you haven't read
that? Not that one, yeah.
That's funny. I mean, I don't know. I haven't really kept up with Pynchon. Some of them I read, you know, and as far as realists I read like Alice Munro. I mean, I think her stories are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for a good read. I don't really get involved in like the bigger overall philosophy of literature these days. I did that in college, and it's like now I'm like, I'm just looking for a good read and a good story and, you know, like how when people do things interestingly with structure, those kind of things, and it's I can't be that comprehensive about it now because I'm busy writing myself, you know what I mean? Which is, I guess, good and bad in a certain way. As far as, Gardner and Harlan Ellison go, I don't even know what he said about Harlan Ellison. I mean, I swear to God, I have no idea, but, you know, Harlan Ellison, he wasn't the only one that Gardner was dissing at that time, you know what I mean? So...
I guess, though...
You had to take a ticket and get in line because he was everybody, you know?
I think he was, like, the major sort of speculative fiction writer that Gardner went after. That's why I sort of, I guess, mentioned him. But I think it was also specifically...
You know, the thing is, I mean, Gardner says a lot of great stuff about genre. I mean, you know, if you look at the... I think it's in, like, On Becoming a Novelist or even in one of the other ones, Moral Fiction or something, he talks about... science fiction as a genre, and says, you know, the Academy's really missed the boat here. There's great writers. I mean, there's like, you know, he talks about Sturgeon, he talks about Delaney,
mm-hmm.
he talks about a lot of these writers, and then he says, you know, and a lot of it is crap. And a lot of it is crap.
Yeah.
When who said that? Sturgeon?
Yeah.
That 90% of everything is crap, you know? When he says it, it's okay. When Gardner says it, then everybody gets down on Gardner because he's, you know, against the genre. But I'm telling you, in his office at school, he had the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. He actually published stuff in fantasy in this magazine called Fantasy Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was definitely into these guys. Turned me on to Philip K. Dick. A lot of really good stuff. So I always get that from people that are involved in the genre. Why didn't Gardner, you know, respect the genre and stuff? I don't think he liked Harlan Ellison. Probably that's what it was. That's neither here nor there to me. I don't really know Harlan Ellison, so I don't really know his work all that well. So you know, it doesn't faze me one way or the other. I have no reason to defend him or to not defend him on it. You know.
Well, I was sort of suggesting that it was the confrontational sort of approach of Harlan Ellison's that he didn't care for. I mean, it seems that maybe he may not have cared for in fiction in general. And I guess I was trying to sort of, you know, offer a kind of thought as to what extent is your fiction confrontational or
my fiction confrontational? The thing is, I have to say what you're talking about and one of the ways you're talking about, I understand what the question is now. I'm sorry, I didn't really understand what you were saying.
Oh, no problem.
One of the things I think about in confrontational when you say that is you're talking about people who are trying to get a reaction,
mm-hmm.
who are writing to like, you know, to piss somebody off or to get some kind of reaction, you know what I mean? And I see this a lot because I teach creative writing now. I didn't do it for a long time, but I teach it once in a while now. And I see a lot of young guys writing this kind of like, can we curse on this show or not?
Oh, absolutely. It's a podcast, so.
Okay. I call it like skull fucker fiction. You know, it's like, you know, heavily goth and like, you know, dreadful death and, you know, bleeding and blood and, you know, like all of these, like these kind of movies, you know, like that come out now, like this Saw 2 kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to get a reaction. They're not very good at it, though, because there's no specifics in it, you know? It's not like, like that, if you know that writer, Chuck Palahniuk.
Oh, yeah, Chuck Palahniuk, yeah.
Yeah, he has a story called Guts, which is just awesome because it's really detailed and descriptive, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not there yet. All they want to do is, what they know that they want to do is they just want to get a reaction from you. And you know, the thing is, they feel that, like, to be very solemn and depressing and stuff like that and horrifying is to be profound. And I don't buy that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times these people who want to be like, you know, who want to, you know, get a reaction out of you feel like that's being profound in some way. And I find profundity much more in the works that are more profound are the ones that are more measured. The ones where there's a real story involved in it, you know what I mean? That involve me more. Instead of, like, turning me away, the ones that involve me, I seem to find more in. And they seem to take me to different places more often and more wonderful places more often. And that's not to say that I'm completely against it. And I tell you the truth, I have read some things by Harlan Ellison, some of his short stories that do take me to those places, you know, really in wonderful ways. I don't find him that confrontational as far as his writing style goes.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that he is in true life, but the one time I met him, he was like a sweetheart. I don't know. He came to our college and he gave a talk and he signed everybody's books and everything.
Well, there are actually two sides to Harlan Ellison, actually.
What?
There are two sides to Harlan Ellison, as I understand it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know him that well.
Yeah.
I've only met him once.
Well, anyway, to get off of this and to talk about your stuff, you noted in an interview with Jay Tomeo that the act of sitting on one's ass and wasting time daydreaming seems to be a lost art these days, being kept alive by a meager few of us crusty practitioners. Now, how does your fiction hope to reclaim this lost art?
Well, I do a lot of sitting on my ass, man. Well, you know, what I was talking about was this. I feel bad, I teach college. And I see my students, when I went to college, you know, if you had a part-time job, you could make ends meet. And you went to college, you went to learn things, and you had time to think and so forth. These poor kids today, man, they're working full-time jobs, and they're going to college full-time. They have no time to sit around. Their lives, they're the busiest people in the world, you know, and still it seems to me like they don't get to do anything for themselves. Like when I ask them, what are you interested in outside of school and work? Nothing. They can't have an answer for me. Nothing. You know, and some of them do have interest, and so I think that's great, but I think the other people are just so run ragged by existence these days that they, you know, they don't have really time to daydream or to imagine and so forth. And everything is so chop-chop and rush-rush and, you know, just sitting around. Like, I remember when I was a kid, we'd go down to the graveyard and sit there with a bottle of MD-2020 and blow a joint and spend like half the day there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't get away with that these days. It sucks.
Yeah. Well, do you think this will have an effect perhaps on future writers? Or?
Well, you know, the thing is, the people who actually end up doing stuff in life and, like, you know, being successful. I had a student once who he went through school. He did well. I had him in a writing class. But he came to me one time. He said he didn't know whether to go into a business degree or to pursue an art degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
I told him, like, do what you want to do. Do whatever you like, you know? This is the advice I got from my old man. You know, follow whatever course you feel is the best. Just become really good at it. So he did. He went and he became a tattoo artist. And now he has his own shop and everything. I mean, you know, he works in the shop and he's got clients and all that stuff. He's happy as hell. But he had an interest, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the people who are going to be writers of tomorrow are the people who are already interested in it, and they're already working on it. I see some of them, you know, sometimes.
Gotcha.
I have faith. I mean, there's a lot of really good people out there.
Okay. I don't
know if that really answered that question.
Oh, no. It totally. It was just a brief aside. I wanted to ask you about the Dave Itzkoff controversy. Now, many people, including Gwenda and myself, pointed out that Itzkoff's top 10 science fiction books were, like, really inept, very biased towards white male writers. And, you know, when the New York Times Book Review can't even get science fiction straight, how can the genre achieve sort of a respectability outside of the genre, meaning, you know, beyond the sort of breakout authors like Margaret Atwood or Daniel Keyes or George Orwell?
Well, here's what I think about that situation. I thought the list that he had there was lame. You know what I mean? And I think the list was lame for a lot of reasons. And I think maybe it was Glenda who mentioned it, or maybe it was Karen Joy Fowler who mentioned, you know, the fact that it was, you know, no women.
Yeah.
You know, nobody other than white males. You know what I mean? Which, it's, even if you were to do a, if you were to do a really you know, if you would do a more extensive list than you would to do any kind of list that had, like, the people who really belong there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those people would be included. Minorities and females would be included on that list. You wouldn't have to, like, stretch to get them on there. But, I mean, so that's the guy's list. Okay, a lot of people said, well, you know, that's his list. That's what he likes. Okay. But one of the things that list pointed out to me was the guy really has no connection to what's going on today in the genre. Because if you're picking out people who, and I saw the people that he liked, you know what I mean? And I like some of those people too. But if you knew who was writing to these days, and you look at his list, you mean to tell me you can't find a place for Ted Chiang on that list somewhere, or, you know, one of these other guys? I mean, the list seemed very outdated to me.
Also, using Looking for Jake instead of, like, say, The Scar, you know?
Well, I mean, just that book. This is. I mean, Looking for Jake, trying to be able. Exactly. I mean, that's a great point about Petito Street Station or something. Yeah, that was like, I don't know what he's trying to do there. Like, appeal. You know, maybe he thinks that book, because China's work is very popular, he's going to appeal to a certain group of people with that or something. I don't know. But all said and done, maybe that is the guy's list. What I hope for, and I think there are some signs in the review that he did, which I think he was very positive about Marisek's book, right? I think that's how you pronounce his name.
Yeah, I think so.
I understand he's a really fine writer, and I've read other things about that book. I've not read that book, but, you know, it seems to me like he was really kind of on target with that review, as some people said. I think, actually, you're talking about Glenda before. She said, you know, she thought he was. And that gives me some hope, because maybe now that he starts to move in that world, you know, he'll be educated about what's going on, and he'll, you know, pick up, you know, where he should, and, like, start to recognize some of these other things. That's all you can hope for, you know?
Well, but simultaneously,
what I'm hoping for.
Simultaneously, though, I actually unearthed the New York Times book review of The Girl in the Glass, and it had an absolutely strange criticism. It was Chelsea Kane's review. She said, "While Ford resists showy prose, his love for language is evidenced as he peppers his colorful tales with words like rigmarole and mawkish." I was like reading this going, what's wrong with rigmarole and mawkish?
Well, the other thing is that whole review, you know, it sold books to me. So, I mean, if that's one of the reasons, like, you like to have a review. And people saw that as a very positive review. When that first came out, I mean, I have a blog or live journal. I mean, I was writing on it. I think this is a terrible review, because it dismisses all the darkness in the book and makes it into this, like, boy's adventure story where it's like a young adult story. Ellen Datlow, who's an editor, wrote to me and said, I read the review of the book. Is it a young adult book? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really think that book is really a young adult story. I mean, Girl in the Glass, you know? So I had problems with that, too. And other people mentioned the, you know, that thing with mawkish, like, that's such an unusual word, you know? I don't know.
Well, you're lucky you didn't...
She sold a lot of books to me. God bless her, you know what I mean? But that review, I thought, was very backhanded in a lot of ways, too, you know?
Well, you're lucky you weren't writing sentences like, Stately Plum Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead.
If only I was.
But, I mean, I guess what I'm sort of suggesting here, though, is that... you know, I actually criticize the New York Times book review on my blog on a regular basis. And I guess, given the Itzkoff list and given the reception of your book is sort of like, oh, he's using the word mawkish. I mean, how do you think that the sort of the book review actually matters? Or, you know, will the audience necessarily be there? Will they be there irrespective of the actual review?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I mean, when you get down to it, review in a New York Times book review is going to get you readers.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's a terrible review, you're going to get readers. So in that case, I'm all for it. Have I seen bad reviews in there? Not just of my work, but of other works, or dismissive reviews that didn't, you know, that weren't, you know, that really where the person was trying to push some, grind some axe instead of, like, you know, review the book. Absolutely. I've seen them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes have I seen good reviews in there? I could just think of one off the top of my head. I think it was Jonathan Lethem was writing about Colosso, you know, the guy who wrote writes the books about the mythologies, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, you mean the Colson Whitehead book, or?
No, he was might not have been that, but he was using that. He was writing a book about Kafka, I think, you know?
Yeah.
It was good. It was a great review. It was an interesting essay, like, in itself, you know? So, I mean, I find good things there. I find bad things there. I don't read it like, you know, all the time. And I don't read a lot of other people's reviews. I will see them if they're friends of mine or if I'm interested in a book. I do look at them, but you know, I think there's bad ones. I think there's probably good ones in there. I don't know. I really don't feel any kind of you know, one way or the other about it. I like it when they're in there and the people buy the books, because you know the thing is, even if they might misrepresent them to some extent. People are going to buy them and read them, and then they can see what's in there. On the other hand, the other side of that sword is they're not going to buy it because they've misrepresented them, you know? So I don't know where to come down on that. I don't have any really great strong feelings one way or the other about, you know, their review or anybody else's.
No problem. But I mean, we're talking about sort of genre eugenics, so to speak, where, you know, okay. Science fiction and mystery they can't be categorized in the fiction section. Do you have any sort of...
the thing is, I always thought that this was bullshit, to tell you the truth, but you know, the thing is, I see so many quotes, and if you know Ansible, the British guy who does that, always finds quotes in the media all the time about people dissing SF as, like, not literature, and Cheryl Morgan comes up with some on her Emerald City blog, too, every couple of, you know, weeks. And so I know it's out there. I mean, that feeling is out there. The people are just, you know, they can't live outside of, like, these strict, regimented boxes. They just can't do it. Even people who are educated and should know better.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is, I think, you know, they grew up and they went to college and they learned how to read in college. And what you learn how to read in college is the canon, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's what literature is. And so, you know, anything beyond that is going to be problematic. I went to college, but I never read the books we were supposed to read. I always read other books, but we were supposed to be reading those. Then I'd go to class and just bullshit about them. You could get by on that, too, you know? And then just read the good stuff outside of that. But, I have a problem with that. I see it. It's bothersome to me.
Yeah.
All I can do is write what I can write. I'm sure I could have made a lot more money or been a lot more popular as a writer if I didn't write the kind of books that I did. Because if you take a book like The Girl in the Glass, people don't know how to take that. Is it a mystery? Is it a fantasy novel? I mean, you know, or Mrs. Sharpook was nominated for the World Fantasy Award, but then people think, well, it's not real. There's elements of it that's not a fantasy. Is it a mystery novel? Like, I've seen that book shelved as a horror novel, as a literary novel, in the science fiction and fantasy section, and in the mystery section in bookstores. You know what I mean? So it becomes, you know, it's difficult in that way, but you got to write what you want to write, man. And these genres, these strict genres, they bore me.
Yeah. I suspect, though, that you could probably, like, secretly go into bookstores and recategorize all the Jeffrey Ford books in the fiction section.
Well, I was just talking to a friend of mine last night at this party I was at, and I was saying that they got one copy of Girl in the Glass in this local bookstore that I always go to here in South Jersey. And, like, I've moved that book so many times, it's starting to get dog-eared. Now nobody's going to buy it. You know, I move the books aside and then put it face down, then I move it to a different section. I've handled that more of that book. I can't expect anybody to actually pay for it now. I've handled it so much.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's so stupid because it's one poopy bookstore out in the middle of nowhere. You know what I mean?
That's hilarious. Well, Jeff, it was a pleasure chatting with you. And
yeah, I had a great time. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Where we sailed and we laughed with our father. I will not desert him. I will not desert him. No matter how I may wish for a coffin so clean, or these trees to undress on their feet.